Motopod, proudly supported by Roadskin, a UK label specializing in protective outerwear for motorcyclists. Modern biker clothing that you can wear all day long and engineered to save your skin. For the road, for life, visit roadskin.co.uk. Hello and welcome to Motopod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 767, May 13th, 2024. We're going to be discussing all the racing from Le Mans, and to do that, I will have to have my friend Richard Jowd with me. Richard, great racing from the weekend.
Oh, I'm still tingling from it, Jim, to be honest with you. Four great races, and yeah, really looking forward to talking about them because there is much to discuss, as always.
Yep, shout out to the Le Mans crowd. Almost 300,000 people packed in there for a weekend of racing. That's commendable, people. Plus it was great weather too. I mean, usually it's break out the raincoats, the woolly hats and everything else, but they were blessed with great weather. So, well, that's what we're going to talk about. But guys, hey, we still would love to have more people subscribe to the show. If you can help us and throw a little money in the pot, be greatly appreciated. Just go to our website. There's links to PayPal and Patreon, and we would love to have more help. Helps us do more things, get to more interviews, more stuff like that. And if you enjoy it, please do. If you can't subscribe, that's fine. We understand. Please go to wherever you get your podcast. Leave us a review. Leave us a like. That'll help us get back to the top of the algorithm again. And with that, I think we shall move on. Oh, a quick shout out. We did have some conversations with Jacob Rowler on there.
Yeah.
Very kind words were spelled to us, Jacob. Thank you very much. I really appreciate the comments about the Coda interviews. That was me being very much outside of my comfort zone, although it doesn't sound like it. It's just I have a rough time just walking up to somebody and saying, hey, we're going to do this and talk. And so it was well worth the pain that I suffered in doing that, and helped me to grow a little bit in a way that I was not used to. So we appreciate that feedback. Also, Jake informs us that if you have HBO Max, their coverage is not the Dorna coverage. It is actually BT Sport, I think, who is on there. So if you are in America, I guess you could be anywhere with HBO Max, and you want to use that to watch the races, you have a choice. You don't have to listen to the Dorna feed. I'm so ingrained in listening to the Dorna feed that I don't do it any other way. But
I haven't sort of listened to the BT. Oh, well, it's called TNT Sports now, isn't it? So I haven't really listened to that coverage for quite some years. Like you, Jim, I'm just sort of ingrained into the Dorna feed now. People tend to be a bit sort of hard on the Dorna commentary team for some reason. I think they're great. I like listening to them, but again, I'm used to that, their format and their delivery. But certainly the BT Sport, or TNT as we call it now, is very, very good as well. So if that's available to people outside of the UK, then that is definitely worth checking out. Yeah.
Great. Oh, with that, we will talk the news. So before the weekend began, we had the drop of all the rules for MotoGP for 2027. These are quite interesting. We will start with what we already knew or had assumed. I think maybe we even had a little exclusive on this one.
I think we did.
They are going to 850 cc's. Now, to quell everybody's fear of the 800 and corner speed mayhem, they made the very wise choice and said, the only thing we're changing is the bore. The stroke must remain the same. So when you do that, you can rev a little bit higher, but in theory, it should be a torqueier motor that they should be able to ride, because we are trying to work on the containing the revs and whatnot. And there's also less gearbox options that they'll be able to put into the engines as well. We also get one less engine per season, so it's six per rider in the engines. There's a fuel reduction as well, which is we are now going down to 20 liters from the 22 liters. Now, if that sounds familiar, we were that way with the factory bikes for a while, where factory bikes were limited to 20 liters. Everybody else got 22 liters, and that was with CRT. And then Ducati was running a different electro was running the standardized electronics package, so they were allowed 22. Now everybody's got sort of a standard electronics package, so we're all going down to 20 liters. I don't know what this one's going to do with it, because 20 liters is tight to make some of the more thirsty racetracks. Chief among them, one that jumps out, is Japan at Motegi. That is a very thirsty circuit. Even at 22 liters, these guys had some trouble making it there. So this is going to be interesting to see. That's going to be the interesting take of all this right here. It's for that. Okay. So that's the motors for it. Rich, anything on the motors that you'd like to add to any of this?
No, other than just to reinforce what you said, Jim, which is that they've clearly tried their best to learn the lessons from the 800cc era, where they didn't put certain restrictions in, which kind of led to those very peaky, revvy engines, which kind of encouraged high sides in corners, which was exactly the opposite of what they were trying to achieve in terms of safety. So hopefully this will go some way towards allaying people's fears that we'll go back to that kind of a situation again.
Yes, hopefully. Oh, I did forget to mention that we will be 100% sustainable fuels. I will not get into how they define sustainable fuels. We'll let that slide, because there's no bearing on what we're doing here. We're racing motorcycles, and that's all that we care about.
Well, that's an emerging technology in of itself anyway, isn't it, at the
Oh yeah.
moment? So a few years down the line, it might be different again. So
Well,
we'll see.
again, yeah, when we get there, we may know more of exactly how they're talking about how they're actually carbon neutral and sustainable, which we don't know the whole details as, again, the process that you would use. I'm fascinated from an engineering standpoint. Like, I really want to know, but they're really kind of shaky on what's going on. So we'll leave that.
I believe the precise wording involved the use of the term specifically non-fossil fuel related. So,
Yes. So it could be algae, it could be any kind of plant-based, it can be all kinds of
carbon
different
capture
things.
type. So, who knows?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, God only knows, but we'll
God
find
only
out.
knows. But that's the answer. That's that part of it. Okay, so let's talk about the more cool parts of this. Now, I think everybody and their brother, we've did it on the show. I think you and I both agree we've wanted ride height devices banned, just for the pure sake of it. I think they were so close to a disaster with a couple of failed ride height devices that it had to go. And they did. They did ban all ride height devices, including the hole shot device, which I would have made a concession for. I'm not gonna lie. I would have said, fine, you can have a one-time use only, mechanically locked, holding the springs of the front forks there, like they do in motocross slash supercross. I would have been okay with that. I would have allowed that. The riders, from my understanding, lobbied for it on grounds of safety for the starts, so they won't take and flip these things over backwards on themselves. However, no go. Every ride height device is banned starting in 2027. I think that's a good move.
Yeah, I mean, I'm delighted about that. I think possibly some riders might have been in favour on keeping the front device for starts, but I would imagine probably not all.
Right.
And like all these things, I mean, once everybody's got the technology and the devices, there's no inherent advantage in having them at all, really. Obviously, Ducati had that sweet spot with both the front and the rear, where they did maintain some advantage because other people didn't have it. But I just think getting rid of it is the right thing to do now. It has no real, application on the roads unless it was done in an electronic format, and obviously electronic suspension is not allowed in MotoGP. So yeah, I'm just pleased to see the back of them, to be honest. I think they make the bikes look hideously ugly as well. So there's no real benefit, and obviously they are making the bikes faster. So part of these new rules are to slow the bikes down, both in terms of top speed and in terms of arriving at corners and exiting corners, because both of those things affect top speed and safety. So I just think it's the right thing to have done in this particular case.
I think also my take is that you banned the ride height devices. Now, if you let them have a front ride height device, Digitalini would have came up with some way to work around that, and it would have been actuating on the track somehow. So if you just ban the whole thing outright, then no one's circumventing the sport. The how do they say that? The intent of the rules, right? No one's running around there. It's gone. It's gone. Hey, you can't have that. So I think that was keeps us out of a gray area that we need to stay out of. Now, there are some concessions. Arrow has been allowed to stay. However, the Arrow is now based, the wing width goes from 600 millimeters down to 550 millimeters. So that's as wide as they can be on the front. I think that's a good idea because I think we've seen enough evidence, especially from Jerez, of that wing crawling over Mark Marquez's shoulder from Ben Yaya's bike wing over Mark Marquez's shoulder. Not that it got close to his neck area anywhere, but you can see that there is that potential. So if you bring him in a little bit more, that's going to help. Also, the rear seat is now part of the standard Arrow kit that you have for your motorcycle. There is now no more freedom to put wings and flip ups and all these other things on there throughout the year and change them as you go. You have one seat that you're going to homologate, and that's going to be your Arrow package, if you will, for it. We've also had limits to the weight. The minimum weight has been lowered. Is it lowered, Rich, or raised? I can't remember which way it goes.
It's gone down to 153 kilos.
So,
yeah.
Okay. So we went from 157 kilos to 153 kilos there. GPS data sharing will be amongst everybody's going to get GPS data, which is going to be very interesting. Now, this is a scary part for me because when we had 800s and we only had 20 liters of fuel to get us somewhere, what did they do? They started running different fuel maps based off the GPS data of where the bike was on the track. Evidenced by the horrendous high side that Jorge Lorenzo had at Laguna Seca. And there was some other instances. Oh, the shortcut at Mugello that caught the bike out because it wasn't where it thought it was. I hope that they somehow, that this data sharing is something that is being policed by Dorna. I believe it to be. I think it's Dorna's giving you all of this data as opposed to letting the teams sort of harvest that data themselves, which they would figure out a way to cheat the system. But I think it's Dorna. I believe it to be Dorna controlled. Am I right, Rich, on that one?
Yeah. So my understanding again on this, and there's a very good article on motorsport.com by Matt Oxley, of course, where he goes into this in some detail, but so back in the 800 days, of course, they were running their own electronics, and so the systems were much, much more advanced, whereas they can't do that with the standard ECU. And the GPS data is not going to be available live during a session. It will be given to the teams afterwards. Now, I'm not quite sure completely what benefit that is to the teams, other than checking what lines people are on and stuff. But according to Matt Oxley, the main benefactor of this information is going to be the sort of the safety aspects of this, so that they can more accurately measure crashes when they happen. Where did they start? What was the trajectory? What was the speed of the bike? Where did it end up? You know, so they can go into much more analysis on this kind of thing. Again, with trying to keep tracks as up to date in terms of safety barriers and protection and et cetera, et cetera. So I think that's kind of the more primary reason for it, but quite why the teams get to have dibs on each other's GPS data after a session is finished. I'm a little bit unclear on that. So that's maybe something we'll have to try and dig into.
Yeah, I think we might have to. I could see where teams may want to be able to have that data. They could figure out a top speed of everybody else's bike. They could look at different points of acceleration and know where they are losing. So if you have that data, I think there's a lot you can gain from it from a team perspective to figure that out. But we'll see how this all goes. Again, we have years to go. No one said that these are definitely in stone, to my knowledge. This is what we were told. But as with all things, I think you could, if they want it, could change something along the way.
Like, I guess. But
I think that would be possible. But
quite a bit of agreement between the teams and the manufacturers, I would think, at this stage, because this is official now. So, but as you say, Jim, we don't know over the course of the next, two seasons or just slightly more, all sorts of new things might emerge might cause these to have to be revisited. So, I mean, in that sense, I take your point.
Well, I was thinking perhaps maybe the some of the Arrow may be tweaked along the way for the new rules is what I'm thinking. I also think that the concessions are going to be tweaked because as it stands right now, in the rules that they explained to us was that all the current teams are moving to a tier B concessions. So Honda having these extra days to test, so they can test with their team, that will be eliminated in 2027 for Honda, for Aprilia, Kawasaki, or Kawasaki, for Aprilia. I was trying to somehow put track house together in there. I don't know why, but it came out. But all those teams, KTMs, all those will all be at a tier B. So that means that they're obviously, anybody who's new that comes in, they get a full set of concessions. Now, the only people I think that are coming, who may be coming, would be BMW. Although I don't know if that helps or hurts BMW's cause, but we can always hope for another set of bikes on the grid.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense to me as an opening gambit. You know, it's a level playing field for everybody that's already here. But if you're coming in completely fresh, then you are going to need that extra help. So it kind of makes sense to me. Again, like you say, it might get tweaked a little bit as we go forward. And it depends if anybody new does commit to the championship. I mean, I'm hoping, I've got everything crossed, that BMW do come, because I think they would be a great catch for MotoGP, you know, to replace Suzuki, who don't appear to be coming back anytime soon. And given what World Superbike and Kawasaki are up to, highly unlikely that Kawasaki are going to show back up in the MotoGP paddock. So there are not that many candidates that could come or will come. Yeah, but it makes sense to give anybody that does come absolute full concessions for one or two seasons, whatever it'll be.
All right, just so since you mentioned World Superbike, we'll move to World Superbike news. If you haven't heard, Kawasaki is essentially leaving World Superbike. They're, how should I put it? They're going to give motors to Bimota, who Bimota is going to build a bespoke bike around that engine, and then they're going to come to play in World Superbike. I think it's Kawasaki getting ready to leave, is my personal opinion,
Well,
but.
that was my thought too, Jim. And I don't want to sort of preempt too much the show that I'm going to put out after this one goes out, where I have a long chat with Greg Haynes. And I was completely unaware of the fact that Kawasaki bought Bimota some years ago.
Oh,
So
I did
that
not know
is
that.
part of the Kawasaki Heavy Industries, which is obviously a ginormous, you know, conglomerate. So again, I don't want to sort of go into too much detail now, because it will come out in the show with Greg. But effectively, this is their way. But Bimota will build a very expensive road homologated special, which will then be eligible for World Superbike. And so it will go up against the V4 Panigale, basically, which is a 50 grand motorcycle, depending on what version of it you get. And you know, Kawasaki have been trying to compete with something that's much, much cheaper and is purely a road bike. So the Bimota thing, I think, is a bit of a clever way of homologating something that you'll only have to sell 200 versions of, or whatever the rules are these days. It will be fantastically exotic and expensive, and it will be eligible for World Superbike. So I don't see it as Kawasaki getting out, because they own Bimota. It's a bit of a kind of technical marketing masterstroke, potentially.
Yeah, but
So,
are they, but is the factory Kawasaki team still going to be there?
it will effectively be what's there now, just rebranded.
Right. So
So I think it's
to me,
semantics.
that's sort of, it's semantics, right? Because like, to me,
Yeah.
Kawasaki is leaving because there isn't going to be a Kawasaki on the grid. There'll be a Bimota, which, okay, maybe is owned by Kawasaki with a Kawasaki engine, but okay. Anyway, listen for Rich's interview with Greg Haynes, that will be out after this show, so you can do that. BSB is this weekend. They are in Donington Park, and you will be there.
I will, getting wet and cold again and blown over in the wind, no doubt, because the forecast is hideous. But yes, I shall be there at least some of the time, and we'll be looking to get into a bit more depth with the guys and girls at Tag Honda Racing this weekend. So, as well as keeping an eye on all the racing that's going on, which will be good, because Donington Park always is.
Yep. Barber Motorsports is this weekend's spot for Moto America. Mr. Bolton will be in attendance again. And there will be episode 766, I think, just dropped the today, which is
Yep.
all the interviews that Scott got for us from the guys in the paddock at Moto America. The Northwest 200 was took place last week without any serious injuries. So there were three Superbike wins for Irwin, two Superstock wins for Davey Todd, and Supersport wins shared between Cooper and Todd as well. So we are now what in the warm up to the Isle of Man, which
Yeah.
is the last week of May and the first week of June, I think.
It normally is. I'm assuming the dates are consistent, with the last few years. Just by the way, Jim, in my notes there,
Yes.
the JM on the podium again. So that's John McGuinness got
Oh,
the
McGuinness on the
podium in the
podium again.
Superstock. First time he's been on the podium there
Years.
for, I think, getting on for 10 years because he had a huge crash and broke his leg really badly a few years back. Maybe it was 2016 when that happened. So great to see McPint back on the podium because I think it was quite a surprise to him. But a great pleasure and a great surprise for everybody concerned, really, because I mean, if you want to talk legends, he's always in the conversation, isn't
Easily.
So, yeah, but good to see that the Northwest 200 went off without any nasty incidents. I mean, there were some crashes and there were a couple of kind of biggish ones, but thankfully, to my knowledge, no serious injuries, which is always a relief, with that event. And hopefully, the same will be the case with the TT as well in a few weeks.
Yes. Okay. So with that, let's do what we do best and talk about MotoGP from Le Mans.
Yeah, blimey,
We'll
where to start?
let us start with Moto3 qualifying, and we'll work through to the big guys at the end. Not going to sugarcoat this one. The first qualifying session was a snooze fest. Rolstein, Lynetta, Ogden, and Suzuki all come out of that to get to the second qualifying session. And to be honest, the second qualifying session was a bit of a bore as well. It was Alonso v. Holgado, each of those taking their shot at the fastest time that they could produce. It wound up with Alonso taking a pole position over Holgado with Jose Rueda third, which, remember, Rueda was absent from COTA, absent from Jerez due to one, an appendicitis that was emergency surgery in the US, and then a serious infection that he received as a partial as of the operation, which is now all claimed. I was amazed. I first of all, I'm amazed that he's riding. Second of all, I was also wondering, gee, I wonder if the kid's going to be strong enough to actually take on the rigors of racing a motorcycle for the full distance in the race, which we'll find out that later. But from there, it was Adrian Fernandez being the first Honda, then Colin Vire, who got sort of, I think Vire got mixed up with some yellow flags and some other things that happened during that time, and he didn't quite get the run that he wanted. I think Vire would have been farther up the grid than he was, but that's how the cookie crumbles. Ortolo would be sixth. Our friend Joel Kelso was seventh. Then it was Munoz, and then Piqueras and Yamanaka were your top 10 there for qualifying. That's how they would go into the race. Now, in the race, the morning of, we learned that Fernandez would receive a double long lap of inconvenience, as you like to say, Rich, because of his transgressions that ha his transgressions that happened for him with putting around in one of the free practice sessions that happened. So as the race took place, Alonso got a whole shot over Holgado, over Rueda, and Munoz, who was flying. Munoz was up to second very quickly, and Holgado passed Alonso to actually lead. Then Piqueras, my gosh, that kid has some large attachments, as we like to say here on the show, because he was around the outside of a couple of people in the Dunlap chicane, which is crazy to think that he was, on the outside doing that. But he used that to make his way to fourth. Vire would move up to third, and then Piqueras again on the outside of everyone at Dunlap as well. It was amazing riding there at the beginning by Piqueras, showing why he was a rookie that was highly touted coming into this season. Just from that, 15 to go, we had Holgado out front, followed by Munoz, Vire, Alonso, Piqueras, and Ortola. This seemed to be sort of the normal thing that we've seen from Alonso now is, he's back in that lead group. He's sort of in his spot, and he was kind of just stuck there. But it was like, well, was he stuck there, or did he not have any pace? Did he learn his lesson from Jerez that, like, if you go out there and you run out front, you pay the price sometimes? But Holgado was out front where he likes to be. Holgado, we know, likes to control a race from the front. Now, with about 13 to go, Ricardo Rossi had moved his way up to fourth and was zooming past everybody. It's like it looked like he had like an extra 2 horsepower than everybody else. It was bizarre that he was that quick. Vire had moved himself to second, and then Rossi would go down at turn 11, having been helped by Munoz. Munoz would then receive a double long lap penalty for the indiscretion. Rich, good call, bad call.
I thought it was a harsh call, particularly it being a double long lap. I mean, when you have contacts and somebody goes down, you can pretty well guarantee there's a penalty coming. But I thought it was a marginal fighting for the same bit of track. I didn't see any malice in it. I mean, Munoz, I think perhaps is a bit of a victim of his
Reputation.
own reputation from time to time, in a way that we used to say about Dennis Onchu from time to time in Moto3. So whether that played a part, I mean, it shouldn't play any part at all. I mean, each incident should be judged purely on, its merits. But in the circumstances, I thought a long lap might have been just about okay. But a double long lap, I thought, was very, very harsh. And that might have been more about sending him a message than anything else, which, if it was, I'd think that's wrong.
Yeah, when I first saw it, I was instantly thought, that's a load of crap. And I didn't want a penalty out of it at all. I thought it was two guys racing for the same bit of racetrack in that fact. And then they showed a couple of other views, and it's like, that was a bit much, in my opinion. And I will land on the same position as you, that the penalty did not fit the crime. A single long lap would have been sufficient, I think, for it. And I agree with you wholeheartedly there. But I also think, as you rightly said, he's a victim of the reputation that he has around the paddock. And a message was sent like, look, you can't do this kind of thing again. But that didn't do that. Well, we were all, or well, I was all about trying to figure out who was at fault in the penalty. Vire moved to the lead, which again, he had pace from the practice sessions and you expected him to be there. And he was sort of the outlying qualifier just because of the way the yellow flags came out. But normal service was resumed with Horgado going right back again. I think he is of the Troy Bayliss ilk. If attacked, reattack. If you don't attack again, attack again, again. And if it's not the next corner, then do it 2 corners later. Who cares? But go back to the front when at all possible to enforce the fact that you are the fastest man on the racetrack. Yamanaka had now joined the lead group of them because it wound up being Holgado, Vire, Alonso, Ortola, Piquera, and Yamanaka. Vire would go back to the front again, and he and Holgado had a big coming together at the turn one, turn two area of the track, the very high speed first section as you peel into the Dunlap chicane. Now everybody goes out way to the left to bike le right or left to get onto the curbing to change the angle of approach and carry that speed into it. And that's where Vire was. He was really on the quote unquote racing line. Holgado was running a tighter line, and the two of them met at the exact same spot in time. It was quite the save by Vire. I really was thought it was amazing he actually stayed on the bike at first. I thought for sure we're looking at, given Munoz's situation, that there's going to be a long lap penalty coming for Holgado. They did not do that, Rich. Why?
Because, and there's been a fair bit of chatter on, I was going to say, Twitter X about this, not necessarily to do with that incident, but certainly some stuff that's been going on in MotoGP, where I think some of the more senior riders, and there'll be one or two in particular who tend to be quite vocal about this sort of thing, criticizing race control and the stewards again. And we've been singing their praises a little bit recently, but there is this underlying current of, what's the right word? Angst, I suppose, that they are penalising outcomes, not intentions, or near misses and stuff. And my initial thought, like yours, Jim, was that was quite a hard collision between Vire and Holgado. Now, I'm not suggesting I don't know which one was quote unquote to blame, because they're racing hard, they're going very fast at that point. But had one of them gone down at that point, that would have been a very serious accident indeed. And my initial thought was, well, if you're going to penalize Munoz, for what happened there, I don't see how you can leave this. But there wasn't even an investigation, I don't think. So
I don't remember one.
again, because there wasn't an outcome or a bad outcome of it, race control tend to let these things go. And I'm not quite sure that's correct, really. I mean, I don't know if you have a different opinion on that. I'm guessing you probably don't.
I'm with you 100%. Again, they judged, in my opinion, gosh, Munoz penalty based on the outcome that he took down Rossi. This one, they shoved off as well. That was just great racing. Admittedly, Holgado even realized that what he did was wrong with the quick wave. Like, hey, look, I didn't really mean that one. That was like, I got sucked in there. I didn't think this through, kind of a thing. And he quickly did it. Now, conspiratorially, did he get off because he tried to actually, hey, look, I was in the bad and quote unquote held his hand up and said, look, I know what I did was wrong. If that's the case, then you have a problem in race control where you are, again, you are penalizing an outcome and you're not penalizing the intent of what happened. And I'll leave it there.
Yeah, I just think it's a slippery slope. I mean, if you can't treat similar things differently just because they end in a different way, because every single incident will always end in a different way. And if you're only going to penalize people if somebody goes down, well, I don't see how that's tenable, really. So, I mean, Holgado was very lucky to get away with it. And as you say, he did acknowledge the fact that, that wasn't quite right. Let's put it in fairly gentle terminology like that. I don't know what Vaya had to say about it. I don't think I heard him say
He
anything
didn't
about
really
it
say anything
afterwards,
much
but
about it at all. I think he assumed it was racing.
I mean, they're going for the same bit of track, and that close quarter racing at that speed, incidents will happen. But David Munoz could quite easily say exactly the same thing, and yet he got a double lap long lap penalty. So I just think that's a bit uneven, that sort of thing, when it happens.
Agreed, agreed. This late in the race with five to go, the front three are who we expect. Ortolo is running fourth. Esteban has now joined in on the fun. So is Yamanaka, and Piqueras has fallen down to sixth. Munoz then crashes at turn 11. So his race was done at that point, and it was all over. Ortolo would move his way to third. Vaier would go past Holgado, and then Alonso would lead, but Holgado would go back by with somewhere around like two to go. And then with one to go, Alonso leads again. And then they touch coming through the chicane there. I think it's through the Dunlop chicane they were touched. There's, again, true Alonso style. He leaves it to the very end and wins the race, having had Holgado do all the donkey work leading the race the whole time. He sat back, cruised, and just showed up when he's supposed to. I think this is his fifth win, I believe. Fifth or sixth win, something like that. It's something small. But I think every one of those wins were always last lap passes or within the last two laps passing to win. It's very reminiscent of one Mr. Rossi, as in Valentino, in the early noughties, if you will. Rossi would just hang around in the pack. And it was like five to go. Rossi'd be like, oh, it's time to race now. It seems as though Alonso has that same sort of mentality as well. And he can pull it off too. He is a phenomenal rider. And he is of the generation of Pedro Acosta. So I'm looking forward to seeing Alonso move himself into, be potentially a Moto3 world champion. Potentially a Moto2 world champion, and then be fighting with Pedro Acosta in MotoGP for years to come. And that's a very tasty proposition, I think. But to continue where we were, Alonso having won, Holgado being second, Vaier on the podium, then Esteban being fourth, which is a career best for him. He seems to have started to come together, to flourish now, to be at the front. We'll see what happens in the next races. Then Ortolo and Fernandez from a two long laps early in the race would make it all the way to sixth. After that, it was Yamanaka, Rueda, Suzuki, and Piqueras. Props to Rueda for making it the whole way. I know Carlos Sainz in Formula One had his appendix taken out, won the very next weekend or whatever. It's not the same thing sitting in a Formula One car as it is racing a motorcycle, people. Let's be honest with us. For Rueda, and I think Rueda's whole situation was way worse than what Sainz's situation was. For him to be back in eighth, I thought was a fantastic ride. And Piqueras would fall back to 10th, having been, you know, in that lead group most of the time. Victim of circumstance, basically, is all the crazy aftermath of everybody going every which way. I think Piqueras was more caught up in that chicane coming together of Alonso and Holgado as everybody sort of dove around to figure out how to get out of there. You know, Piqueras just was on the wrong end of it, which happens sometimes.
Yeah.
But a very good Moto 3 race. It was, again, you're waiting for it all to happen on the last few laps, which is the norm. And it didn't disappoint, for sure.
Other than the couple of incidents we've talked about, it wasn't a scintillating race, although there were a few really good passes, as you pointed out. But for me, the real takeaway is Alonso, he learns from his mistakes, doesn't he? Because I think it was in Parc Fermé when he got the pole position on Saturday. He did make the point about going easy in the early part of the race before his front tyre was up to temperature. So he's learned his lesson from Jerez, where he did look, you know, as if he would just bolt out at the front, which is not what we've tended to see from him. As you say, he tends to do the hang around in the front pack somewhere in the kind of second to 10th kind of region. And he has just outstanding racecraft, doesn't he? I mean, he's so clinical in the way that he gets past people. I mean, he pulled off a mega pass on the penultimate lap, I think it was. He went past two bikes. I forget whereabouts it was, but I made a note, you know, just an incredible pass. And you just know he's coming on the last lap, don't you? So yeah, he's formidable. And I totally agree with you, Jim. I think he is already marking himself out as a kind of a Acosta-level talent who I would say is going to be favourite for the championship this year. You never know what's going to happen to people in Moto 2, but yeah, he does look really, really, really promising, this kid, doesn't he? And yeah, he just keeps doing this, doesn't he? All of his wins, as you say, they're hanging around in a pack, just biding his time, waiting for other people to mess themselves up or burn the tyres out, and then he just pounces with two to go or one to go, and people just can't deal with him, can they?
No.
Very impressive.
Again, I hate to beat this drum, but I will. Props to Pirelli. I realize that it was very nice temperatures. It was very pleasant in Le Mans, but it was not like everybody was throwing it down the road at the Dunlap chicane where the tires are cold, having been, you know, because that's the first time that you're going left after a succession of rights that you can definitely cool the tire off in. So props to Pirelli again for this, because they have done phenomenal work to
they really have
to do this. I'm not trying to beat the drum for Pirelli and their marketing or whatever. I'm not suggesting we all go buy Pirellis and put them on our bikes. It's just, think about that. These guys had all been on Dunlops for years, years and years and years and years and years. And Pirelli came in and have not only, I think, given them a better tire to qualify on and to race with, because they've been breaking track records, than what Dunlop gave. Whether Dunlop didn't want to do the development work or whatever, I don't know the situation there, but all props to Pirelli for what they've done.
Yeah, no, and I mean, if Pirelli want to turn up as a show sponsor, that's perfectly fine with us, Jim. Yeah, I can check some tires at our subscribers, you know, that would be no problem whatsoever. But no, I mean, well, I'm not being joking, that would be not quite nice if that was to happen, but
I'll shill for Pirelli, why not?
You know, there were not any crashes in Jerez, and I think you know, obviously there was a crash with Munoz and Rossi, correct, but that was a collision. One or two people might have gone down, but there have been remarkably few crashes actually this year, which would tend to imply again that, you know, there's a lot more grip on offer, which we know to be the case with the
or feel,
and well, and that as well.
It could be either or both.
Yeah,
take your pick.
So all of which just points to the fact that they're doing a tremendous job, and I'm sure we're going to keep on saying it.
Yep. So quickly, the championship, Holgado leads 1 point ahead of David Alonso. They're on 94 and 93 respectively. Then Vire is 32 points. He's 31 behind. Okay, there's no reason. This is not a two-horse race yet. They're still in it because all Holgado and Alonso have to do is put each other down, which is very possible.
Yeah.
And then have Vire win, and he's right there in the mix of it. Ortola is fourth, Kelso fifth, Munoz is sixth, then Yamanaka, Esteban, Piqueras, and Fernandez. And with that, we'll move to Moto 2. Now, the Moto 2 qualifying, again, it's probably not the best qualifying that you're ever going to see, although Canet was in the first qualifying session. He recovering from the broken ankle that he had at Jerez, which is his left ankle. I think of all, if you have a choice of breaking an ankle, I think I'd much rather have my right ankle broken than my left ankle broken, but it's his left ankle. I mean, he started out the weekend having to be assisted onto the bike and then was able to walk himself, I don't know, hobble himself onto a motorcycle after that. He would get through the first session along with Zalta van der Gerberg, Santa Aegis, and Guevara. Then we got to the second session, which Ramirez was down at the last turn in the session, so he would start way down. Jake Dixon had a tip off at the next to the last corner, where he was just way too deep and into that one, lost it, and away that went. Arbolino had a point where he couldn't get the bike started for a little bit. It was as if, I'm speculating, and I don't think it's possible given how the systems work, but it sounded like it was kind of like the old school vapor lock on a carburetor, right? It was hot, it sat, it soaked, it basically boiled off all of the fuel and couldn't get any cold fuel in it to start. Though they did switch out the different roller. They had, two roller systems. Maybe one of them just was low on battery or something. But Arbolino did have to get off, and his mechanics then did start the motorcycle, and then he was off again. That whole episode just seemed to be very surreal that was happening to Arbolino.
He's just not having a very good year, is he?
No.
Just everything seems to be going wrong.
Yes. I mean, dare I say it, he's becoming Celestino Vietti-esque, where he just disappears for long portions of time and then will magically reappear for a moment in time, which is very sad.
Jim, it occurs to me, actually, bearing in mind both Moto2 and Moto3 have had the switch onto the Pirellis.
Yes.
Moto3, the competitive order hasn't really been terribly affected by the change of tyres. If anything, people are, as we were just saying, are doing tremendously well. And whilst the lap times are lower in Moto2, there are some people that are clearly struggling and have vanished from trace. I mean, Aldegar had a tricky weekend.
That I was going to talk to you about.
You're going
this.
To come to him.
We'll do it now.
Yeah. But, whereas conversely, Joe Roberts is taken to these tires, like a duck takes to a pond, but Vietti, I mean, he's out because he crashed in the Jerez test. So he had a broken collarbone, I think, or a shoulder injury. So he wasn't even in Le Mans. And I mean, what's going on with Arbolino? I mean, he had a poor second half of last year. We know that to be true. And he completely fell away in the championship. But he is in all sorts of bother at the minute, isn't he? And whether that's tire related, obviously, we don't know for sure, but he is certainly a person that looks in jeopardy in terms of maintaining a ride, I would say, beyond this year if he's not careful.
Well, he's got a 2-year contract with Ducati.
No, Arbolino.
Arbolino, sorry.
Yeah.
I was stuck on Aldegar. Sorry.
I mean, he's a quality rider, so he's not going to disappear, but I'm being over dramatic. But,
I don't think I think he's in danger of losing his Mark VDS ride.
Yes.
Certainly. Now, does that mean he shows up on a Taltrans or Fantic or something else? Take your pick. Yeah. Don't really know, right? So yes, I agree. Let's kind of come back to all this after we get through the race, because there are some very valid points and questions I want to ask you as well. But I think we need to the where results are from that. Qualifying, yes. Oh yeah, where were you? Oh yeah, Aigura had a bike problem. It appeared as though that the chain was loose. Apparently, there was some spacer problem. I'm like, wow, that's KTM had that problem with Miller's bike, and then at Jerez, and now Aigura. Hear me out here. I think it's inexcusable at KTM because there are two bikes. This can happen given the high pressure intensity environment that you're in with a single bike. So. But still, we've never really had a spat of these kind of little niggly problems, either for one of two reasons. One, we've either never known about them because of the coverage or however, or because of the rigors of a 22 race calendar, people are tired and are now making mistakes.
Possible.
Because if you know, one of the things, again, Formula One analogy coming here, people. When Formula One was testing all the time, and you were allowed to test all the time, they had 18-ish, maybe 20 races. And then they stopped all that because it required you to have a full-time test team of mechanics because the strain was too great for the people who were traveling with the cars. I don't want this to be the case with MotoGP, but it's been agreed upon that what 22 is the limit and there can be no more. Hear me now, Liberty Media, no more than 22, which gives the MotoGP guys 44 races in a year. Anyway, all right, sorry, I'll jump off the soapbox.
Jim, that
Please.
reminds me, just to not correct, but to go a bit further on the new engine rules, where we said that it's going down to six per rider. That applies if there are 20 or less races in a season. If there are 21 or 22 or more races in the season, then the engine allowance goes up to seven, just so that we're absolutely 100% correct and clear on that. I meant to say it earlier on, and I forgot. So,
I even
yeah,
forgot
so,
about it too.
yeah.
So, anyway, continuing with Moto2 qualifying, I swear we'll get through it together. Canada actually crashed as well, and he was literally hopping on one leg to get out of the gravel trap there. Canada crashed. Then we had Audiger would turn up to be 13th, and because of all the crashing and all this, we wound up with Canet on pole. Roberts was second. Garcia was third. Arenas got really shortchanged. He was on a very good lap, which got canceled because of the Canet crash and everybody else crashing at the very end. Because Salach bumps into Arenas at the end, at the very end of qualifying, on the top of the hill there, past the Dunlop chicane.
Yeah, that was
And
weird.
very, very weird. Again, that was always when I was racing my fear at the end. It was at the end of the race because some guys want to close the throttle as soon as they're past the checkered flag. Some people would want to carry that to the first turn and go, okay, we're all going to break here and then mind your way back to the pits or whatever. So always a tricky spot there. I always tense up at the end of the race because I'm just expecting somebody to do something really dumb. I've seen it happen a couple of times. Again, it's club level, but
Last year in Le Mans, at the end of the Moto3 race, when Joel Kelso went piling into the back of somebody for that
It might have been.
same reason,
I think it was. Not sure.
somebody closed the throttle off. Yeah, and he went absolutely, looking down or looking at the pit wall at his team or something, just absolutely piled into the back. So I'm pretty sure it was Le Mans.
Second row was Arenas, Lopez, and Gonzalez. Then it was Guevara, Agius, Salach, and Arbolino finishing the top 10. Jake would be 11th. I think Jake had a crash in qualifying too, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah,
Yeah, he had a crash there. So it was crazy.
we'll come to Jake, I guess.
And we'll come to
You know,
Jake
his things did not
in a
improve the
minute.
following day.
Yeah. So we get to the Moto2 race. And we learned that of all the riders that are the top riders, Joe Roberts is on a medium front. Everybody else is on the S1 compound front and the SC1 and the SC0 rears. But Joe's on a medium front. And I'm thinking, at this point, I'm going, it's either a master stroke or it's the stupidest thing you've ever done. I mean, it was like it could only go one of two ways in my mind. But at the start, Garcia grabbed the hole shot from the inside, sort of the dirty section of the racetrack. Fabulous start to be that way. Roberts was second, then Gonzalez, Lopez, Arenas, and Guevara. Canet went back to eighth. Audiger, who we never mentioned where Audiger was. Audiger was 12th for qualifying, which was, again, yellow flags and everything else affected Audiger's final couple of laps. So I'm thinking Audiger's going to make a charge in this race as well. But Audiger was in ninth, so he had moved up a few places. Gonzalez was into fourth, and then Lopez was pushing him wide, and that's how all that started. Baltus would go down at turn 14. Canet would make his way to fourth. Then, broken ankle and all, he make his way to fourth. Gonzalez went down at 14, and then Canet got by Roberts at Dunlap, and then Roberts went back, was also passed by Lopez, because the Joe had to slow down as a result of what Kennett had done. Kennett basically parked it in the middle of chicane, so Joe lost all of his drive, and that let Lopez get by. But Roberts did go back by Lopez, so there was the fight back from Joe, which I was glad to see at this point, because honestly, most times you don't see Joe fight back. He's there and he gets passed, and it's like he kind of stays there, or then the next guy passes him. I don't know if it's like a, I have no speculative point, but maybe it's just a psychological thing for him that he would just like get past, like, oh, I can't do what I want to do with the bike. And then the next guy passes and it just gets worse. Here, at least, there's some mental fortitude. I'm fighting back. I'm going to get on with this. And I was glad to see that part of it. But
I wonder, Jim, can I just say, I wonder if that's because he has so much more confidence on the Pirellis.
it's entirely possible, which is the other speculative point that we'll talk about as well with all this, because I think all these things tie back in and onto all that. But Garcia is basically gone. I mean, he's starting to get away at this point in the thing. Kennett has gone by Roberts. And then it's Lopez after that. It's Arenas, it's Guevara. They're there. And then Lopez just barged his way past Roberts at 13. I mean, it was pretty much like, again, not to rant about the officiating, but if Munoz gets a penalty for what he did and Holgado doesn't get a penalty, well, then I guess it's consistent that Lopez didn't get a penalty because he didn't crash Roberts, although he did take 7/10 out of his lap time, having been in the dirty area of the track there where the cars actually meet back onto the circuit. At this point, I wrote, I wonder how far back Roberts is going, because at this point, I felt like the medium front tire was definitely the wrong choice, given how everybody else is going on their front medium tire. Or sorry, their front soft tire, my mistake. And I'm like, oh gosh, here we are. We're going to go backwards. It's like, oh, you know. Well, with 10 to go, we had Roberts in fourth. The front three are Garcia, Kennett, Lopez. Agura and Chantra have now made their way up, which was surprising that Agura was way back when he started. He was 17th off the grid, and he come running through the pack to this point. And still, you've got, good grief, 10 more laps to go. Nothing really changes here until there's four to go. When Aya Gura gets past at turn 13, he uses that braking point to go past Roberts. Like, oh, okay, that's not great. Then Lopez goes by Kennett for second. And when that happened, it was like everything came together again, except for Garcia, who's so gone, he wins the race by a mile and a half. But that whole attack that happened by Lopez and Kennett, those two guys having gone at each other, instantly brought Roberts, Ayagura, and Chancha right back into the race. So now things got really interesting as it wound down. I mean, by 2 laps to go, everyone's trying for second place. They're all trying to figure out who's going to be on second place. Ayagura got by Kennett when Kennett went wide. Then Ayagura went to second, followed by Lopez, followed by Roberts. And, Roberts was up a little bit. He then fell back again, got repassed. But the race would finish with Garcia winning, then Ayagura. So that was a 1-2 for the MT Helmet squad. That's a 1-2 for Boscacora. And then Alonso would beat out Roberts to take the podium, which meant all three bikes on the podium were all Boscacoras, followed by Roberts in fourth, then Chantra, Kennett, who went backwards. I think the pain that he must have been experiencing was off the charts. And he still held on to finish sixth, which is an amazing ride. Heck, I mean, Kennett was almost destined to win the thing, it seemed like. But it seemed like the other time he had a broken leg or something, he had a very strong race. And he just has an amazing threshold for pain, apparently. But then Arbolino got salvaged in eighth, followed by Arenas and Guevara. The point here is that the Boscacoras look amazing on Pirelli tires. And people that we don't expect to be at the front, Joe Roberts, Chantra, right, are doing really well on the Pirellis. But people like Audiger are doing horrible on the Pirellis. Arbolino, horrible on the Pirellis. Arenas is hit or miss either way, so I don't know if you really want to classify that. But given that data set, you got to think there's something about the Pirellis that are causing this problem. What do you think is the issue here, Rich?
Oof. Well, I don't think I'm really probably qualified to give a terribly informed answer to that, Jim. I mean,
Well, you got to have an opinion, right?
I think possibly Le Mans as a track plays its role as well, because there are a lot of long radius, fast turns. There's quite a lot of heavy braking, so stability and feel is clearly something that's key there. But yeah, I mean, it's kind of ironic, isn't it, that the MT Helmets riders were a little bit peeved to find out they're on the Bosque-Skier chassis. Because that was a late switch by that
Very late.
team. They're probably not feeling too peeved about it just at the minute. Because, I mean, Garcia's starting to look as if he could seriously be a title contender, isn't he? I mean, he's
Very
obviously
much.
l leading the championship, albeit not by a huge amount. But, I mean, he's been a revelation, really. And he had a strong year last year. But suddenly, that, yeah, the Calyx doesn't look like the chassis to be on at the moment, does it? So, whether people said before, although there were only two bikes, I think, last year, weren't there? That it's a bike that's very sweet handling, it's good in the turns, you have to take different lines. And I just think that in combination with the extra grip and the feel from the Pirellis is starting to look like a problem for the Calyx runners by and large, because this is not an outlier race. We've seen this quite a bit. And the only person who's really appears to be having a bit of a struggle with this combination is the wonder kid Fermín Aldeguer. Unless, you know, with the Ducati contract in his pocket, maybe he's not so worried about it now. Although
I can't imagine
I
that.
doubt that that is the case, but because he would want to win the Moto2 championship before he goes up. But so yeah, it's a little bit of a quandary at the moment, and I think we need a few more races to try and figure out a bit better what's going on.
I think one of the issues in this is the lack of dry running at the beginning of the year for the guys with the Pirellis. Some people are going to gravitate to it. It's going to work for their style. Some guys need more time with it. I also think that because the Bosque-Cora is this sweeter handling type chassis, but it takes these bigger radius corners. I'm going to speculate here a little bit because I know when I know Pirelli, I don't think has changed their motto of how they do things, but Dunlop makes a very triangulated tire, especially for the front. So they want a lot of grip on that front. When you're in the corner, Pirelli has a more rounded, they do a triangular type, but think of it as a triangle with big radiuses on the points, if you will. Okay. So it's a completely different feel and they're softer tires. So you've got a chassis that provides feel. You're going to be able to go faster on it because that's the feel that you're looking for. You're getting everything back to the handlebars and you can make these decisions about what you're going to do, which that's where I'm confused. That I think that explains Garcia. I think it explains the Bosque-Coras being all there. It certainly has improved Lopez being on the Pirelli, right? I mean, he couldn't come anywhere near Aldeguer on a set of Dunlops, but as soon as you put the Pirellis on, he's amazing with them, right? Roberts on the Calex, which I think is the stiffer of the two chassis, which is that chassis was more developed around the Dunlops, and it's a lot different. There's a lot you have to change to get between the two. Ride heights are really important. Those things change the bike. It changes its rake and trail because I think if I remember correctly, the Pirelli is a, if you did measure the circumference of a Pirelli, it's smaller in circumference than, say, the Dunlops, especially the fronts because of that triangular shape there. So, given all of that, that's kind of where I think it is with this. But again, this is not a knock on Pirelli. This is making this series look really good too. Track records are still there. And I mean, my gosh, you saw Aguirre come from 17th to second in a 20, what was a 22 lap race. That's crazy. I mean, we didn't see that anywhere before. So I'm really not going to complain about it. It's that oddity. I mean, Aldeguer has, I thought at the beginning of the year, Aldeguer was dealing with the whole contract thing. And I thought, okay, it's out in the open now. Aldeguer's got a contract. Okay, that we all kind of knew he was probably going to Ducati, yada, 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 whatever. Okay, fine. And then I thought, okay, he's going to get it together. So what, right? Because if you, speculatively, if Jorge Martinez is not. I'm not going to be at Pramac next year. There's a spot there that I see Outiger sliding into, whether it's Morbidelli's or whether it's the vacant spot, vacant spot left by Jorge Martin. I'll spit it out. I swear I will. He's going there. I think that's where he's going completely.
Yeah. I mean, just on Outiger then, I mean, we've said in the last couple of review shows, he's been dogged by a bit of bad fortune and a few things have kind of conspired against him. So I think we can give him a bit of a, you know, free ticket on a few things. But this was the first weekend where, other than Friday practice, where he was towards the top of the timesheets, from Saturday onwards, he just didn't look comfortable. So there is something going on there. And he just didn't, I mean, I know he didn't finish too badly in the end, but he was quite a way off the pace and quite a way back, really. Never really looked like he was going to fight his way through to the front, for example, or to the podium at least. So there's definitely something going on. But, and it's weird because, you know, you do hear this more feel and edge grip with the Pirelli front. And if so, if you've got a softer chassis, like the Bosque Scura is a bit softer than the Kalex, as you say, Jim, then you would think that that would suit somebody like Aldegar. But I don't know. Odd, really odd, hard to explain at the minute. And again, I think we just need a bit more, you know, experience in terms of races to come to draw any further conclusions on any of this stuff.
Yeah, it's something to watch, guys. I think it's definitely watch what's happening to Aldegar, because that's the question mark, because I don't think we know what's going on yet, but we need a few more. Let's look at the... Sorry, go ahead.
Sorry, I just got a couple more things on, because this was actually a really intriguing race and quite and a good race at that as well. But with Roberts, I just wondered whether or not he's so confident in that front end, but I think he just maybe felt he needed the slightly stiffer construction of the medium
maybe
to get away with some of the moves, because he's kind of the guy, well, in the context of that race, he's kind of the guy turning up to a gunfight with a knife, isn't he, in terms of the bike that he's on or the chassis that he's on. So he's possibly having to do more on the front end than the others are having to do. So whether that was part of his decision, but I mean, it didn't work out badly for him in the end, did it?
I mean, he finished fourth still. His string of podiums are over, but
yeah, okay. Just as a kind of, I don't want to rub salt in the wounds, Jim, but I do wonder what Cameron Bobier would be doing on the Pirellis had he not departed.
That's a great question. That's a very good question, because the U.S. Dunlaps are softer than the European Dunlaps. They don't have, their sidewall is definitely not as stiff at all. So it's, you know, Cam would probably be well in tune with this and would probably be somewhere in the same zone as Joe Roberts.
I would think so, because if you look at what he's doing on the BMW in Moto A,
mm-hmm.
you know, he's really hard on the front end of that bike, and he tended to be a bit of a front tucker, as I recall, in Moto 2. So again, I think that lack of front end feel with the Dunlops that used to be there in Moto 2 was against him. And I think he would be doing quite well were he still in the Moto 2 Championship. No, I'm not having to go at him. I mean, he left for perfectly sound reasons, but it is slightly bad timing.
He will tell you that the KLX chassis is incredibly stiff. He will tell you that.
Yeah. But other than that, the only other thing I just wanted to say was, let's not underplay Canet's performance over the weekend.
Oh, it's
to
amazing.
Do what he did was just really, I mean, again, he's a guy who's really hard to figure out, and he can turn in a performance like that with a cracked ankle. And bearing in mind how much pressure they forced through the foot pegs to get those bikes turned, that must have been excruciating. So, I mean, huge credit to him for that. And Ethan Guevara, this is the first time we've ever seen him towards the sharp end, as I can recall. And this is what, his second season now. So maybe, you know, one performance doesn't sort of suddenly turn his Moto2 career around. But, you know, you do sometimes see these sort of little incremental steps start to occur, particularly in the second season. So, yeah, good to see him up the front, because let's not forget he's an ex Moto3 world champion, and he hasn't done anything in Moto2 before this weekend. I mean, I think he finished 10th in the end. So not outstanding, but much better than we've seen. So that was something I sort of took note of.
With that, the championship swings. Roberts goes from being 5 points ahead to being 7 points behind Garcia. So Garcia is on 89. Joe is on 82. Aldegar is on 63, which is, you know, again, this is looking sort of like a two horse race, but one mistake from Garcia or Roberts puts, and an Aldegar win puts him right back into contention again. From there, Ayagura is fourth, then Lopez, then Canet, then Gonzalez, Arenas, Alcoba, and Ramirez to round out the top 10 in the points. So we go on to MotoGP. Oh, this is wild, folks. I'm telling you. So in the first qualifying session, we had Vachinini, Marc Marquez, Binder, and Alex Marquez. Wow. First time Marquez has had to go through Q1 with the Ducati. Okay, just shows you that. And Bastianini is there as well, which, okay, didn't really think that was going to happen. Binder had some sort of a technical issue on his bike, and he gets only one chance to get through, which I think he just didn't work because I think he crashed it. And so, well, he would start like dead last, I think.
Yep.
Marquez had a really good, really had the mother of all front slides going into the Dunlap chicane. He laid a blackie there that was just insane, and he caught it. It was like the old Marquez and the old magic had come back. Like, you're just like, yeah, that's how he's supposed to ride. And it just was fun to see him. It's just fun to see Marquez with a smile again. Where he just didn't have that smile.
But worth pointing out, Jim, that he's having remarkably few crashes. I mean, imagine if he'd been on the Honda again this year.
Oh,
I mean,
Ron Mir, I don't think has finished a race yet because of
no.
crashes.
So,
I'll include sprints in that too.
but it tells you something about the Ducati, doesn't it? Now Mark's starting to get to grips with it and he's starting to push and he's having some of these moments, but he's by and large, he's catching them. You know, his skill is starting to come through. Whereas the Honda, it would have just been a collection of parts in a bin, wouldn't it, by now? So, and it's what I heard this on the commentary. I don't know if you picked it up. They tried something with setup on the Friday, and they kind of blew Friday effectively by going the wrong way. So he was really on catch up from that point onwards. And so Saturday just couldn't quite get it together to get through to Q2. But you know, anyway, he made up for it later in the weekend.
Even Augusto Fernandez went down, but it was Oliveira who bumped Marquez out. So Marquez would start 13th. Bastianini had moved on to the second qualifying session. Now, the second qualifying session, Jorge Martin put in the first sub 90 second lap around the Mons, and he did it on his first hot lap that he did.
Yeah.
Martin is something special when it comes to qualifying. I will take nothing away. That guy can qualify. He can hustle a motorcycle, and Martin. And then, once he did that, he promptly crashed in turn four. Okay.
Yeah.
Hey,
It happens.
I'm not one to judge, but it happens. But you know, hey, Bagnaia was second. You know, because he got close, but couldn't get past Martin. Then Bagnaia went down at turn nine. Like, holy crap. So then Alex Marquez was down. And then Miller was down. So there was all these yellow flags that were all over the place. And that ruined Bezzecchi's lap. It ruined Aleix Espargaró's lap. It ruined Pedro Acosta's lap. It helped Fabio Quartararo to some extent there. But qualifying was Jorge Martin having got pole, crashed. Francisco Bagnaia, you know, Pecco. Second, having crashed and created a yellow. Vinales somehow snuck through all of the yellow flags to become second. Gary was probably cursing at the TV set. And then
Yeah.
you had Digia was in fourth, then Bezzecchi, then Aleix, then Acosta would be seventh, right? Then Quartararo in eighth, which I thought was brilliant for Quartararo. I mean, it seems as though Yamaha is making some progress. Whereas it looks as though Honda is making none, if not going backwards still, which is
Yeah.
tough to imagine. Tough to do. Then it's Morbidelli. Bastianini would be 10th. Miller's 11th. Oliveira is 12th. Marquez, 13th, right? So that's how we go into the sprint. Now, the sprint Martin got the hole shot. Bagnaia had a very vicious wheelie. And Mark Marquez would go from 13th to 5th in the first couple of corners. Whoa, watch that one again when they highlight and isolate Mark Marquez. Like, he just picks the right way to go at each point in time. Hung it out on the outside of the first chicane there at Dunlap, which was risky, but paid off, which was amazing. So it wound up being Martin, Bezzecchi, Aleix, Vinales, Mark Marquez, Miller, and then Bagnaia was 15th. He had had a runoff or a crash, or do you think he just, no, he ran straight off into the gravel at the museum corner.
Yeah.
And then rode slowly around the outside and promptly parked the motorcycle because it was his backup bike. He did not start the sprint on his bike that he qualified in because his bike was damaged in qualifying. Said he had zero grip and zero stability in the motorcycle. Wow. That's weird because in theory, those two motorcycles should be exactly the same. Now, there are going to be small differences, and the best of the best will tell you one motorcycle handles differently than another motorcycle, despite the engineer's best efforts to have two sets of forks that are identical, two shocks that are identical. It's down to like the welding and the heat and all that. It all matters, you know, at this level, it all matters that just that, you know, a few microns of more weld causes that much more heat that changes something that makes that bike feel different to the guys that have this kind of talent. So while surprised that Bagnaia's number two bike wasn't quite as good as his number one bike or his preferred bike that he wanted to race, I am shocked that it was that far apart from each other.
Unless, Jim, it was some weird electronics gremlin.
That is possible.
Because, you know, he had that weird little bubble off the line, which...
Yes. You know, I thought he didn't quite have it set right because he really did bad.
Yeah, that, I mean, that can happen for all sorts of different reasons. But, you know, there's sort of all sorts of engine braking and mapping that's part of the electronics package. So my take from it probably was that, we'll certainly never know officially from Ducati what the problem was. But it's hard to believe that it was kind of like a radical problem with a chassis or a tire or anything like that. I suspect there was something electronic gremlin going on somewhere, which just made the bike unrideable. But that was as much as we were ever going to find out.
Yeah. One small frayed line or wire can cause all kinds of havoc in it. So we don't know, but that's where we are with that one. Aleix jumped the start. So he got a double long lap of inconvenience. Wow, by the thinnest of margins, but yep, you're moving, pal, in which that is the rule. No movement before the light, and you got busted for it. Which, you know, hey, that happens at times. You're trying to cake everything there. Martin would go on to win the race. Mark Marquez would get second because Mark would wind up running through and he would wind up making a pass in the S's because Bezzecchi went down in the S's, I think, which allowed Mark to get to that second place and that whatnot. So Mark would be second, Vinales would be third in the sprint, followed by Bastianini, who raced up to a great, good position. Aleix, because of his two long laps, and then Pedro Acosta made his way to sixth from his only really up one position. And then you had DiGiantonio, Miller, and Fernandez. Quartararo didn't even get a chance to score a point, which kind of stunk for them in the sprint race. But the sprint was kind of what we expected. Martin wins. The unexpected was Bagnaia's bike having some gremlin, some problem with it. And the amazing part was that Marquez was able to ride all the way up from his 13th place to second. The weird part was that Acosta couldn't do anything. And you sort of expected Acosta to be able to do, you're waiting for him to do something. He just didn't do anything, which begs the question here because we've had this crazy qualifying and we've seen quite a few bigger names start to crash now in the qualifying sessions. I think it's because we all know now it's extremely difficult to make up places in the race. Passing is at a premium now on some circuits. I think Le Mans probably, if you tallied up the racetracks and you tallied up what are, prime passing zones, I think Le Mans has probably more of them because of the stop start nature of the circuit compared to anything else that's there. But I think these guys are now riding so hard in qualifying to get themselves in a position to win a race that you're going to see more and more of these guys crashing in qualifying. I just think that's where we are right now. They've got to push that hard to do that. So that is the sprint race as it went down. The other thing I want to mention, something, what was I thinking about? It was, no, I can't remember. There was some other tidbit that I wanted to talk about with
Well,
that,
whilst
but.
you're thinking about it, I just want to highlight another conundrum, which is really surprising to me, which is the woes of Alex Rins really struggling to adapt to the Yamaha, which is a surprise. I mean, I think he is still a bit injured with that leg, because that's been a long recovery, that broken leg from Mugello last year. But even so, I mean, he crashed out of the sprint. He was nowhere in qualifying. And yeah, he's having a real struggle, Jim, isn't he, to get to grips with the Yamaha. Now, not to say that he won't get to grips with it. I'm fully confident that he will. I mean, Quartararo had a pretty good weekend, but it was his home race, and seemed quite happy with his overall performance for the weekend and that of the bike. But on the other side of the garage, it's a bit troubling at the moment. I don't know if you've got any thoughts on that, but other than that, it was a fairly typical Saturday race, wasn't it? Banyar doesn't really do much in the sprints historically, whereas Martin is virtually unstoppable. In terms of Acosta, I just wonder if we're, he had such a stunning start to the season. It's kind of hard to maintain that, and perhaps other people had a may have had a slightly steadier start, and are now starting to gather a bit of pace and whatnot, which is making Acosta's life a little bit harder, perhaps. Plus, I mean, again, this was one of the things we were discussing in the email exchange with Jake Rowe, wasn't it? About just what a big crash that was that Acosta had in the warm-up
Oh,
in
yeah.
Jerez 2 weeks ago. That might have knocked the wind out of his sails a little bit. Not a lot, I don't suppose, but life in MotoGP is tough. So I think we might see him just have a little kind of dip for a round or two, and then I suspect he'll come back strong again a bit later in the season. It's just my sense of things, but I think that's what's going on.
I think one thing is we all rate Acosta's talent as incredible. He's on a MotoGP bike now. And you can't help but draw this comparison and say, look, Marc Marquez was a rookie, got on a MotoGP bike, and he won the world championship. Okay, temper your expectations for a minute, people. First and foremost, I will give you that when Marquez came in, there was not nearly the competition that there is now.
Absolutely, 100%.
Ducati and KTM did not have their act together. Basically, it was Marquez battling the Yamaha for the win. That's pretty much where it was. And let's be honest, the Honda was superior in horsepower, maybe not so much in handling, but it was very stable on the brakes, to which Marquez used that as a weapon to destroy the Yamahas and win his titles and win it there. And other people fell off along the way and had problems. And okay, Rossi was not at his zenith anymore. He was on, no matter what you say, Rossi was on the downhill side of his career at that point in time. Acosta is also not Marquez because he has a brain where Marquez literally takes his out in races. I think it's not that he now Acosta's smarter than Marquez or whatnot. Just he has his own limit that he's willing to race to, right? And that's where he is. And he's learning and he's sucking all of this knowledge up. And he's going to become a world champion. To me, he's also hindered by being on the gas-gas. In my mind, if you ask me how good is the gas-gas slash KTM, they are equal to a 2023 Ducati. they're not equal to the 2024 Ducatis. They're
still lacking. Fine. Yeah.
Right. So again, is Acosta probably going to win a race this year? I think he will. When and where, I don't know, but it's not going to be a blot on his championship or his first year as MotoGP that it's going to be some blot on his copybook. Oh, Acosta didn't win a race, so he's not going to be any talent at all. No, not at all. There's still a lot of work that has to be done by Pit Beyer and the boys back in Austria to make that KTM better. They're getting there. It's going to take one, two seasons to get there where they can challenge consistently, because Acosta's got to learn how to do it too.
Yeah, and let's not forget, I mean, Acosta is still learning what the limits of the bike and himself on that bike are, because he's so inexperienced on a MotoGP bike, you know. So, and that might be why he's, relatively speaking, doing so much better than all the other KTM riders who do have a clearer understanding of what the limit of the bike is. And now he's having a few crashes. You know, he's going to go through that tricky period now where you go through crashes to really fully understand the limit of the bike, and then experience and skill will then build again. So that's why I think we're going to see him having this is very much a relative term, but a little bit of a dip compared to that outstanding first two or three rounds. Had the big crash, will have knocked his confidence a little bit. So now he's going to go through a little learning period, I think. I mean, the crash that he had in the main race, that we'll talk about in a minute, was quite an odd one, and he gave a very detailed and an interesting explanation for it. But I still think we'll see him come strong from mid-season onwards. That's my prediction. And I definitely think he will win a race, maybe a sprint rather than the main race, but I still think he's going to win something.
I think he'll win something. Yeah. All right. So we go to the Sunday race. There is the chance of rain. If you saw the first free practice or the MotoGP warm-up, Acosta was fastest, and everybody came in and practiced changing motorcycles, which is the first time I remember seeing that this year where anybody thought that there could be a possibility of, you know, going flag to flag with their bikes. When we lined him up for the race, Benyaya got himself a great start. He got the whole shot over Martin, followed by Aleix, who didn't jump this time, Digia, Vinales, and then Acosta. Bezzecchi had a massive wheelie off the line where something was wrong. Either the whole shot device didn't engage properly, electrical gremlin where the settings or the map wasn't correct. Whatever it was, he was battling that bike to get there, to get it back, and to get it going again. Acosta made a move by Vinales, and you thought, well, this is where it's going to be. He's going to slowly start to work his way up. He's seen what Marquez did in a sprint race. Therefore, he's probably going to, you know, start putting this together now and makes his way. Acosta seems to be a little bit better on the Sundays than he is on the sprints, unless he, you know, qualifies better, and then we may see something different as he goes along or whatever.
Yeah.
But it was basically a Bagnaia versus Martin battle sort of at the front. Then Acosta goes down at turn eight. He's trying to get past, past Digi and Aleix were there.
Yeah.
So he goes into that turn, which is downhill, having only ran two laps of fuel off the bike, held onto the brake that millisecond too long, tucked the front, literally went right behind the back of Digia and right in front of Aleix through the little gap of those two bikes off into the gravel trap. And would you like to explain Acosta's definition? Would you like to tell us Acosta's explanation of what happened?
Yeah, because this is a revealing of how quickly these guys are processing information. Now, let's take it that this is precisely what happened and he's telling the truth. Well, I don't see why he wouldn't. So what his explanation was that both, and I think Aleix might have been in front of Digia, actually.
I think you're right.
Anyway, going into that turn, Acosta said they both broke very, very early. But then Aleix having realised that he braked too early, kind of let off the brake again. And so Acosta went for a gap that suddenly started to change because the other guys were adjusting their braking in the second sort of phase of getting into the corner. And he said that in the end, he didn't want to rear end Aleix Espargaró. So he basically pulled the brake on much harder, knowing that he was likely to crash. And it was just absolute luck that he went between the two bikes and didn't wipe either of them out, because it was millimeters, if that, of gap. So he explained it slightly differently, not that he just overcooked it and braked too hard with a heavy fuel load, but that, yeah, he saw a gap because they braked early and then they released their brakes, and he knew he was gonna then was gonna run into them, so kind of chose to not chose to crash, but was forced to brake much harder himself, and that's what caused him to go down. So, and all that kind of happened in what, 2 seconds?
If
So,
that,
if that, yeah. So just
probably a second and a
incredible,
half.
just incredible, really. And then to recall it in detail like that,
Oh yeah, I could do it too. When I was riding all the time, it's amazing what you will understand, what you could think, what you remember, and what details you can pull out. It's amazing. So Acosta now out, down and out in this one, and he doesn't really have the greatest track record at Le Mans. He crashes Moto 2 bike there a couple of times, if I'm not mistaken. Crashes Moto GP bike there now. Yeah. I'm not saying that this track is a bogey track for him. It's just somewhere where he's had some mistakes and has crashed there. Meanwhile, back at the front, nothing too much has changed. It's still Bagnaia, followed by Martin. Aleix is now third, then Didier, then Vinales, then Marc Marquez. And now Bastianini, who came from far back, is now with Marquez. It's like, okay, that's really interesting. Didier would take third off of Aleix. Vinales would go by Aleix the fourth, and Marquez would go by as well. Once Aleix got sort of banged out of the way, Marquez just vultured it and went right on through as well, which, again, shows that Mark can be aggressive on the Ducati, take advantage of the things, the mistakes made by other people, which he used to be able to do on the Honda, which he couldn't do. And, again, happy Marquez is a fast Marquez. Bastianini then goes by Aleix, and neither of them make the corner. Now they're going into the chicane on the backside of the track, right? There's a name for it. I don't remember what it is. Aleix is late on the brakes. Bastianini is even later on the brakes. Aleix kind of just sets the bike up and rides straight off on the access road, if you want to call it that, and rides on. Now Bastianini attempts the corner, goes into the corner, is ride and cuts the corner and comes back out. Now they wind up giving Bastianini, he got a long lap penalty for that. I was trying to think if it was one or two.
It was a
I
one,
it was one. Okay,
which is a standard
standard, right?
sanction for that shortcut.
So that's the key. Initially, I thought he was going to be given a penalty for the attempt at passing Aleix, but that's not the case. The case was that all the riders were told, because there used to be gravel there, and it's been paved, that if you cut across there, there is a specific amount of time that you are required to lose to not get a long lap penalty. He did not lose enough time, and that is why Bastianini got the long lap penalty. Now, I don't know what kind of electronic wizardry they have on these motorcycles as far as being able to tell you how much time to drop, but if you were just trying to do it off of feel, I think it would be almost impossible to do as well. So that happens with Bastianini. He gets that. Now,
Jim, that's not a
yes.
new thing either, because we were ranting about this because exactly the same thing happened to Brad Binder last year
Yes,
in the
that is
race.
true. It's
And we were
it's
talking
a
about
it's a
this. How are you supposed to measure a 1 second? Because
yes.
I said it's an automatic sanction if you cut the corner there, if you cut the corner and don't lose the amount of time, to be precise. And I think it's a second, but yes, how they're meant to judge that in the thick of, the action is hard to understand, really.
Yeah, and I don't. Yeah, it's super weird, but Marquez is now gaining on Didier, and so he takes a shot at him at Dunlap. But Didier hangs on. Quartararo was then down at turn nine, so his race was done. Back at the front, still Bagnaia, still Martin. Marquez is now has gotten to third. Vinales is fourth, and then Didier. Now, this is an interesting one to me. Didier got a long lap for the shortcut at turn three, which is the start of the Dunlap chicane. I thought this one was completely unfair. because he and Marquez are racing. He stands the bike up because Mark has occupied the area that he's going to take to avoid the contact. Digia slows down, looks, and even lets Vinales past him. In my mind, why are you giving a long lap penalty? Because Digia knew what had happened. He simply backed off, let Vinales by, and then passed him later. To which race control says, no, you didn't give up enough time because it's a known quantity of how far you're supposed to be. And I'm thinking, this is ridiculous. Digia did, in my mind, the exact right and proper thing. Hey, I got pushed off. I'm shortcutting this. He looks over his shoulder, looks at it, calculates it, gets it to where he falls in behind Vinales. He even gave up a place, and he still got penalized for it. Do you think that was the right call, Rich?
Well, I mean, I don't know what the rule is in that particular
turn. It's the same thing. You have to give up a specific amount of time.
Like you, I thought he slowed up massively as he came out of that and rejoined the track. So I was as surprised as you and probably him that he got a penalty for that. And just point of order, although I know they sometimes adjudicate these things differently on lap one, but Vinales shortcutted on at the start. And
but
again,
he did give up a place or two.
And he sat up and did give up a place or two as well. But then so did Digia. So, and obviously it didn't happen to Digia on lap one. So maybe they give them a little bit more leeway because of the number of bikes going into the turn on that first lap. But anyway, it was a odd call to me.
Yes.
And I mean, I haven't seen any sort of major follow-up on it. I think Digia is one of these sort of fairly relaxed sort of people. So I don't think he was kind of like banging his... He wasn't doing an Aleix Espargaró, sort of waving his arms at everybody and banging the table about it. But, and of course, race direction don't give, or the stewards don't give detailed written explanations as to why they do certain things in one case.
I think they should.
Not in another. And
they should have a right. They should write up each one and say, this is what we found. And this is the rule that we executed, or not executed, but imposed. And that's that. And I think we'd all be more happy because at least we'd know where they're coming from. And as opposed, because this inconsistency here bugged me. And I get it. There's a certain amount of time that you're required to drop, but I think that's very hard to do on the bike. And it wasn't like Digia just whipped through the shortcut, throttle pinned, and passed Marquez. No, he knew what had happened. He clearly looked behind. He clearly saw Vinales. He clearly dropped in, slowed down, dropped in behind him. And that's that.
Yeah, agreed.
I don't know what they're thinking sometimes, but they did. Martin then tried at Dunlap to get past Benyaya, but he wasn't able to. Then Martin got by at Dunlap again, and this time it sticks. It was a great aggressive pass. Now, you can say what you want, but you got the feeling by about this point in the race that Benyaya was trying to hold up Martin. Martin had pace in hand, but couldn't figure out how to get by. Or Martin rode the smarter race and let Benyaya take some of the tire off of his bike and then pounce at the end when he was able to. But Martin was able to get by Benyaya, and that was fine because now it was Martin, Benyaya, Mark Marquez, Vinales, Bastianini, and Digia having served the long lap. Then Martin wound up wide at Dunlap. Like he blew the corner with like three to go. And you're like, oh, whoa, maybe the front's going. Maybe he doesn't. Maybe the front got too hot being behind Benyaya. You're not sure what was going to happen. But along with that move, he maintained it, but it sort of brought everybody sort of back together again. So the gap that he was making, because I do believe he was trying to check out on everybody, and he was succeeding in that case. Benyaya did not have the pace to run there, but that brought Marquez into the fight with Benyaya because Benyaya was losing pace and Marquez still had pace. And so then it becomes this Benyaya Marquez battle for the last lap. Martin scooted away. He's going to win this. But Marquez waits until the chicane on the backside of the circuit, does an aggressive move to get up the inside of Benyaya, moves him out of the way, and would finish second. So your podium is Martin, followed by Marquez, followed by Benyaya. 2 days in a row, Marquez comes from 13th all the way to second. And one was with a great start. One was with what I thought was a great ride by Marc Marquez. This is a different type of Marquez. We've never really seen him really come through the pack before. I mean, I'm sure he's probably did it on the Honda somewhere at some track, and I don't know where it is. I mean, you could say he came through the pack in 2020 at Jerez only to toss it off the road and break his arm in half. That's probably the closest comparable that I can come up with real quick. But it was definitely a different Marquez. It was a different race for him. And with him finishing on that podium behind Martin, that leaves you with the Ducati conundrum that Gigi Dallini must solve. And that is, who rides beside Marc Marquez rides beside Benyaya in the factory Ducati team? I'm all tired up with words. Who do you think goes there, Rich?
I mean, it's hard to look past Martin at the moment, isn't it? But there is something about the way Gigi Dallini interacts with Marc Marquez that just keeps that little shred of doubt in my mind. I don't want to get sort of too into conspiracies here, but there are a few different things at play on the periphery of this as well, Jim, which is kind of like really interesting to me. The big one is, do Yamaha get a satellite team running? And if they do, which team is it going to be? Because that has a big potential knock-on effect on all of this. And it might be that Ducati need to wait until Yamaha conclude a deal or don't with one of the satellite squads. I mean, realistically, I think it can only really be Pramac or Gresini. Of the two, I would say Pramac is the more likely, but then that raises the problem. What happens to Fermin Aldeguer? Because most of the sensible money, I believe, was on him riding for Ducati in the Pramac squad.
Agreed.
So there are some other things at play around this that isn't just about, is it Martin, Bastianini or Marquez that goes to the Lenovo Ducati Works team? I kind of feel that Bastianini is likely to be out, in which case I see him ending up replacing Espargaro at Aprilia, because Aprilia want a fast Italian on the bike, and so, you know, Bastianini would certainly fit that bill, either him or Bezzecchi. Bezzecchi's not having a great year at VR46, so I mean, he might be a guy that could move to Aprilia, but I think of the two, Bastianini is more likely.
Yep. Let me interject here real quick. Make the assumption, go with this assumption, Pramac becomes Yamaha based.
Yeah.
Do you not think VR46 gets the works bikes? They'd have to.
Oh,
Gresini's
yes.
Not going to get that. So in that case, Bezzecchi stays at VR46 because they get the factory bikes.
Well, Marquez at Gresini might get a 25 bike, because I think Dallini would want him to have one.
I can't argue VR46, that either.
With VR46, we saw Marini on the year-old bike and Bezzecchi on the, you know, the up-to-date one. So there is precedent for that to happen.
Yep.
So there are some interesting peripheral moves that have to take place before this really unfolds. But if I was a betting man, I'd say Martin gets the call. And then what else happens in and around it, who knows? But, you know, is Alex Marquez perhaps a bit vulnerable? Probably. Is Digia a bit vulnerable? Probably, because Aldeguer needs to be found a seat, having been signed.
I think Oliveira and Raul Fernandez are vulnerable at Trackhouse.
Very.
One of them isn't going to be there because Joe Roberts is going there. Nothing's been said, but I think the handwriting's on the wall for that. This is so intriguing. This part of this thing is so intriguing to me, because I'm going to look at it from Gigi Dallini's point. This is the only way I can look at it. If I'm Gigi, right, I'm going, I want that talent on my motorcycle. Yep. And I'm going to look at Tardozzi and go, you figure it out, because he's getting a 25 bike. Whether we give Gresini a 25 bike or whether Pramac leaves and whatnot, I don't think Gigi Dallini wants Jorge Martin around. Not that I don't think that he thinks he's not a fabulous rider. I think that there's what happens on the periphery of how he conducts himself is not in line with Gigi Delina and how he wants his riders to act.
I agree. I totally agree with you, actually, Jim. Yeah, I don't think Martin would be a good fit in there from the Bagnaia camp's perspective.
Well, they're not going to like Mark Marquez either, right? They'll tolerate Mark because Mark is... this is the wrong way to say it. I have no other way to say it to you people and have you understand. Mark is way more professional in what he says and how he says it than Martin. Martin's a loose cannon to some extent about what he says and about how he acts. Well, it doesn't matter. I'm not going to be a Pramac anyway. Mm. Mark Marquez would never say it, right?
And Mark would be there for a season or two, possibly, whereas Martin would be a much longer term, prospect or problem, depending on your point of view. I mean, the heart sort of says Marquez, although Mark Marquez himself actually might be more than happy to take Grassini, provided he has a 2025 Spec Ducati.
Exactly.
I think he fits in there nicely. It's a good environment. It's a good, great team. He's got Frankie Carcetti in his corner there. They're working really, really well together.
You can see them gaining momentum and trust, and it's going someplace, right? I mean, you think about Mark had spent all those years with Santi Hernandez, right? And he can't work with him anymore. So it's like a marriage, right? You've got to work at it. They're still in the dating phase, right? They don't know if they're going to get together with you, but they're leaning towards engagement now, right? It's kind of how I look at it. But it's just how Marquez is as a person in PR world.
Oh, I mean, that
he's
would
a
be,
gold. He's gold.
Absolutely. That would be the reason for him to be there, really. I mean, it would be a dream come true from a marketing and a PR perspective. But Jim, here's one to wrap your head around then.
Okay, go for
it. So if Pramac end up as the satellite Yamaha squad, and they're going to get a lot of money thrown at them by Yamaha to do it, clearly, to give it to the Ducatis, and Yamaha know that they need a proper second pair of bikes out there. We know that Martin's leaving the team. He's made that abundantly clear. Morbidelli is another rider who must be under pressure for a spot in MotoGP, and he certainly wouldn't want to end up back on a Yamaha, having just got away from the thing. So who the hell rides for Pramac if it's a Pramac Yamaha squad?
Crazy,
you might see some people coming up for Moto2 to fill some of these spots, because I can actually foresee 3, 4, possibly even 5 riders leaving the current MotoGP field.
Okay, I agree with you. Let's count down the people that we think are vulnerable in there. I think that you have Raul Fernandez and Miguel Oliveira. They are very vulnerable at Trackhouse.
Yeah.
Whether you want to believe it or not, I think Aleix and Maverick Viñales are very much questionable at Aprilia. They may or may not, but if you believe that Yamaha is going to Pramac, you don't think Aprilia would make a run at getting Jorge Martin on their bike.
I'm sure they're doing everything they can.
They would, right? Yeah. The guy's incredible. Even if it was only to win sprint races, they would still love it. So I think Aprilia has maybe a set of guys who are more logically staying, but you know Bastianini's got an issue. He's going somewhere. He's not there. And you know Morbidelli's probably got an issue. He's not really going anywhere. So if you look at that, that's 6 riders on the go that are could potentially be out of there. Now, does Bastianini show up on a Yamaha at Pramac? That's possible. I think he would be really – I don't think he'd like it that much, but I think he'd do it.
Yeah.
I mean, does Rins move to the satellite team of Pramac? Doubtful. But he does tend to thrive in that kind of a team.
Yeah. I mean, don't want to get into too wild a speculation.
No, we can have
even,
a whole show.
Even,
just on
the
speculation.
Weekend, they're even talking about Mir jumping ship and ending up on the Aprilia at Trackhouse, potentially next to Roberts. That would actually be a pretty
sensible
move.
That'd be actually pretty good. That'd be a pretty smart move.
Because I still think Mir's got a lot in him, really, and clearly the Honda is so bad at the minute, he can't find his way around it. Fair enough. Not many people have been able to do that.
Nobody ever really does figure a Honda out. They just simply get it to submit slightly. That makes a lot of sense, because Justin Sparks has enough money to put
whoever he wants, basically.
Whoever he wants on there. I mean, he could have Roberts and Mir, and he's got the money to make that happen. Yeah. That's not an issue. He's got plenty of cash. Plenty of cash. I don't know. It's crazy. It's crazy. There's a huge shakeup because I think Miller is at risk of moving off of that because I think Acosta's going there despite whatever he says about loving being in Hervé Poncharel's team and being around Hervé and Guy Coulombe and those guys.
Yeah. I could foresee a scenario where Miller could go to a Pramac Yamaha. That could make some sense for Yamaha because he's a good development rider. I mean, he's not going to win him any races, but
I think he wants to go to World Superbike. It's an easier schedule. He can be home with his wife and his kid.
Yeah.
I just think that fits better for him. Not saying he's going to do it.
Well, I think that some people thought it might have happened already, actually, but it does become much more of a possibility, I think. But I would even say that, you know, for all the wrong reasons, somebody like Fabio Di Giantino is probably a little bit vulnerable just because of this Firmin Aldegar conundrum if two less Ducatis are on the grid, which does seem like it's going to be the case.
How about this for a wild one? If you're Ducati and you say, well, we want another team. We want another team. Pramac is leaving. Yamaha's throwing tons of money at them. Would you not go down and knock on Trackhouse's door?
No, I just don't see Trackhouse and Aprilia parting ways with each other.
Really?
Yeah.
Hmm.
Contractually, I would imagine there's some commitments there that would be pretty difficult to break as well.
There may be.
You can never rule anything out because money always talks, doesn't it? But I mean, it might be that Ducati would be relieved is probably not quite the right word or not the word that I mean. But having to turn out two more bikes and support two more bikes probably wouldn't be a bad thing from their point of view. But.
Well, they would get 24s.
Well, yeah.
And I mean,
you still got to supply the parts and build the parts and. Depending on how much crash damage there is. So, I don't know.
There's so much, right?
You would imagine that by the time we get to, say, Silverstone in August, a lot of this will be clear. And it'll be good if it is, because I'm obviously hoping I'm going to be there. So you'll be able to try and chat to some people about some of this stuff. But yeah, there's a lot of stuff to get through between now and then.
Yeah, I think that by August at Silverstone, I think the rumor mill is going to be absolutely cranked up on full tilt. So anyway, let's finish. That's the conundrum. Let's finish this. So Bastianini was fourth, Vinales fifth, Di Giantonio was sixth, then Morbidelli, Binders, Aleix Espargaró, and then Alex Marquez rounding out the top 10. If we look at what this does to the championship, well, that puts Jorge Martin on top, 28 points ahead of 38 points ahead of Benyaya. Then Marquez is on 89, which leaves him only two behind Benyaya. For a second, could you conceivably suggest at the beginning of this year that the world championship would be won by a rider on a satellite team? Oh, and by the way, the guy who's going to finish second in that championship is on a year-old satellite team. Your old bike was on a satellite team. It's conceivable.
I mean,
Bastianini's on the same amount of points as Marquez. You got to think the 24 bike is going to keep getting better and better, where the 23 bike is longer in the tooth. Maybe Marquez is not there. I will tell you this. If you watch that race, the 24 bikes have much better squirt out of the corner, and they have a lot better acceleration to get to a higher top speed. Marquez's 23 bike doesn't quite accelerate like the 24 bike. And that's why I think he was trying to get on the ride height device so early, like at Portimao, because he wanted to get it lower to get going, to get faster, to keep up with the factory bikes.
Yeah. I'll tell you what though, Jim, that pass he put on Bagnaia on the last lap.
Masterclass of
he came
breaking.
From miles behind.
He was in the
he?
Same zip code when he was hit the brakes.
I mean, I didn't think he was going to make the turn. I thought they were going to go out, to be honest.
I thought
with
the front end was going to fold, to be honest.
It was a hell of a pass.
Yeah,
I
it
mean, it
was.
really was. And Bagnard did well to sort of just dink himself out of the way. Otherwise, they would have probably collided and gone down. But
But
yeah.
that's why you want Marquez on the bike, because there's
Of
some
course it
sort of
is.
magic
Yeah.
that
You know
will
he's going to
happen.
come. You know he's coming. One way or another, he's going to send one. And if it comes off, it comes off. If it doesn't, well, that's Marquez,
That's
isn't
what
it?
gravel chops are for.
Yeah. And I think that's why Gigi Deligna likes him so much. He's kind of like that Deligna, for all of his kind of technical kind of wizardry and guruness, he clearly just loves a racer.
Yeah.
And that is what Marc Marquez is.
He is the Mark Marquez is the purest racer on the grid.
He cannot not try. And that
Yes.
is basically what racing is all about, isn't it?
Yeah. That's why Gigi loves him, because you hit it on the head. You nailed it. Gigi Deligna is a racer at heart, and he loves Marquez's pure racing aura. And he's just, I mean, you look at DG, man, he's always down in the Gresini garage. He seems to show up in the Gresini garage before he shows up in the Pramac garage. Now, credit of editing by the videographers that are there, maybe, I don't know, but it just seems that way.
I know we've got to round this out and
Oh,
mustn't
yeah,
keep
we
talking
do.
about this because obviously the facts will emerge in due course. But
It's fun to speculate.
I'm sort of with you. I think there's a powerful camp within the Ducati management that probably don't want Martin in there because I don't see why they wouldn't have announced it already if it was that easy of a decision because Martin's doing the business on track, let's be honest. So But equally, I think it's most likely at this stage that Mark gets a 25 bike and stays put in Gresini.
Possible.
So does that mean that Bastianini stays put? Because I mean, he's doing okay. I mean, he's not doing as well as Martin, but they might Ducati might sort of take the view where he runs his gob, doesn't he, Martin? So the big headline on MotoGP.com today, if you've looked, is Martin saying if they don't want me, I'll ride for another manufacturer. So he's really kind of.
He's full of himself.
He's pushing it. He's pushing his luck a little bit because they might just call him out on that one and say, right, off you go then. You can foxtrot Oscar to, Yamaha or wherever you think you want to be. I don't know. It'd be a bold decision if they let him go on performance grounds,
Oh,
but
yeah.
it's a little bit like the whole kind of Senna and Prost at McLaren at the same time. And Ron Dennis says you can put two bulls in the field, but you're going to have trouble. So that's the conundrum that they've got facing them. But it's a good one.
All right, folks. I think that's it. We know what all happened there. I'm just gonna say you can find me on Instagram, Twitter, X, whatever you want to call it, at MotoRGV. He's at Richard Jowett, if you guys want to communicate to us. And with all that said, it was a great race weekend. Looking forward to Catalonia in 2 weeks' time. And then we wind up at Mugello after that, I believe. And it's going to be fantastic. The long straight's going to be catering to the Ducatis there. It'd be interesting to see how fast the KTMs are there as well. Things to look for there. Look to see if Roberts can rebound in Moto2 at a track that, again, he likes. And we shall see what happens. With all that, stay tuned and ride safe.
And I'm just going to throw a question out to the listeners, and hopefully we'll get a few people responding on this. Because this kind of comes up a little bit in the show or the chat that I had with Greg Haynes, which will come out in a few days from now, and goes back to the rule changes in MotoGP. And that is with World Superbike in mind, what does World Superbike do about its rules? Because come 27, if the MotoGP bikes are going sort of 3 seconds a lap slower, which is kind of the prediction, clearly they can't have a production-based championship going faster than the prototypes. So what do people think is going to happen with the World Superbike rules? I've got my ideas. I'm not going to say them now. We'll
I
come
have
back to
one.
it in a future show. Well, unless you want to give your opinion now. Oh, bollocks to it. Let's just go for it then. Sorry, I just swore.
Think they put air restrictors on them.
Okay.
That's what I think. I think you have an inlet restriction and you figure out whatever diameter you want and you run with an air restriction of some kind. Motor can't breathe, motor can't go fast.
You see, I'm kind of wondering whether or not World Superbike, bearing in mind that Lita sports bikes sales have been going off a cliff for quite some time now, and certainly from a European perspective, and I suspect there's elements of this that are the case in the US, Jim. the emission standards are really sort of neutering these bikes now. I kind of wonder whether or not World Superbike don't end up dropping down to a 600 cc formula.
I got to know what the fans think about that.
Yeah.
You heard it. I think they're doing air restrictors. Richard says they're going to go to 600s. You tell us. Motopod at
Or
motopodcast.com.
750, 750
Oh,
maybe.
back to 750s? Okay, I'm fine with
Yeah.
that.
Yeah. Anyway, we'll see. Yeah. Throw it out there. But anyway, as you said, Jim, ride safe and yeah, we'll catch up soon.